is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all this morning. And we have two classes. We have Horning Middle School. Would those students please stand? Welcome this morning. You may be seated. And we have Mayville High School. Would those students please stand? We're glad to see you too. You may be seated. The students are here with us with a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The students are invited to participate with us in an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, the students will get the briefs on the case that we're about to hear, and they may do some work on that case before they get here. They'll then listen to the oral argument, and after the second argument this morning, the students will return and be joined by other students, and a justice of this court will meet with them, and we'll discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of this case. Everyone is welcome to come at the noon session and participate. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is an empty chair. Is that right? No.
No.
All right.
It may look like
We've said that quite often.
The other left.
All right. I'll start on my far left. And there is Justice Lewis Butler, and he's relatively new. This is his last session of oral arguments, having started in September. And seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet at lunch. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is an empty chair, usually occupied by Justice Patience Rogensack, but she will not be participating in this case. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case. 2003 AP 2022-49, which is an odd number here. John R. Arriman versus Howden. Arguing on behalf of ROI Investments is George B. Struther IV. Counsel.
Members of the court, good morning. I am George Struther, also Garrett Struther. I represent ROI Investments today. We bring to you two substantial legal issues affecting substantial rights. The first relates to the interpretation of Section 806.02, subsection 5 of the statutes, which allows a court to enter a default judgment if a party fails to appear for trial. We must decide what this statute means and how it is to be applied, and we have little in the way of prior court decisions to guide us in this respect, and presumably out of this case will come some guidance. It's our position that the first resort in this case is to the rules of statutory construction and to examine the plain and unambiguous meaning, if there is one, of the words used in this statute. And it is our position that there is a plain and unambiguous meaning. The statute says that if a party fails to appear for trial, the court may enter default judgment. We don't need to think very hard about what that means, I believe. I think it means quite simply, if a party fails to show up at trial, the court can enter a default judgment. We don't have to attach any special meaning to the word appear. It simply means if a party fails to show up for trial, the court can enter a default judgment.
Well, let me pause there.
Okay.
Is a court's determination as to whether or not a party appeared, is that determination a question of fact or a question of law?
Well, I think it's a mixed question of fact and law. And in this case, we had to look at whether there were any persons who were, in fact, the party that the court decided to enter default judgment against. And then, in certain cases, it can be a question of deciding whether the showing up in court is somehow a meaningless showing up in court. If a party would show up in court and say, well, I'm here, Judge, but I'm really not going to take an active role in this proceeding, or I am completely unprepared to do anything in this proceeding, then I think a court at that point might say, well, this party has showed up but has failed to make this a meaningful showing up.
That's why I pause, because you say appearance means showing up. And I'm just not sure it's that easy, and you just gave a hypothetical where showing up isn't appearance. Hmm?
And I think that what I told you I believe, but I think in the first instance it's a question of whether a party has showed up. And I think it would be a rare instance indeed when a party actually shows up for the trial and informs the court in a way that indicates that the party has made a meaningless appearance and might as well not be there at all. I think that would be a rare case indeed.
Well, here, and I'm just going to follow up on Justice Bradley, as I understand it, neither party, or I should say partner, no one spoke up for your client, ROI. In other words, this was a trial to litigate, to determine the issues, and there was no one there to do that. Is that, if I misinterpreted or misstated the facts?
I think you have misstated the facts. Okay. I disagree with that interpretation. The ROI Investments was a partnership. It had three partners.
Sure.
And two of those partners were in court.
What did they do in court?
What did they do?
Yes.
Well, the court proceedings started, as you know, with a motion for a continuance, which was brought on behalf of one of the individual defendants one of the individual plaintiffs, who also happened to be a partner. At no time did either of the two partners representing ROI Investments ever state that they were not prepared to go forward with in defense of the claims that had been brought by the respondents, Howden and Scholl.
The judge did not ask that? The judge did not, who is appearing here for ROI?
Did not ask that question.
Didn't the individuals say they were appearing as individuals, not for the partnership?
They didn't. My recollection is they didn't say one way or the other whether they were appearing strictly as individuals or on behalf of the partnership. As I recall, the court noted the appearances at the outset of the motion hearing, which preceded the trial.
What did the court say about the appearances? I think that's Justice Wilcox's question to you.
Well, as I recall, the court noted the presence of the various people who were there, and if I remember correctly, that was Howden, Mr. Howden, Ms. Scholl, Mr. Sumption, Mr. Klein, Sumption Klein being two of the partners, and a colleague of mine was there at that time on behalf of Mr. Klein individually, having brought the motion for the continuance of the trial proceedings.
Who was the attorney of record for ROI?
There was no attorney of record for ROI at that point. The attorney of record had been allowed to withdraw by the court approximately a week earlier.
Okay, so who was representing ROI?
Nobody was representing ROI in the sense that we think of as a lawyer representing a party in a court proceeding. ROI Investments was, at that point, without counsel, and unrepresented in that sense.
Didn't the court basically say, there's no one here representing ROI?
The court said that in so many words.
Counsel?
What's the issue, then?
Yeah, that was my
question.
Well, that was the question that I was, if the court said that and no one responded. I mean, the court, there was no response to that.
And I think that that's because the court's statement in that regard was interpreted as meaning that there was no legal representative, no attorney there representing ROI Investments.
Well, counsel, if I could, now I'm referring to page 13 of Mr. Erlandson's brief, and it refers to the circuit court's comments at the January 23rd hearing. Well, but the partnership is unrepresented here. There's nobody representing the partnership. There's nobody here on behalf of ROI. No one is here representing ROI. As it relates to the counterclaims, ROI is not represented by anybody here at this time, which means ROI is not prepared to proceed at the time of trial. Five different comments at different portions of the proceeding, and according to Mr. Erlandson, no plaintiff and no attorney representing any plaintiff objected to any of these statements. Now, I bring that up because as I see the issue, I would break it down into two. And I want to make sure I understand your view with respect to the concept of appearance. One is whether or not there was an appearance by either of the partners. And then the second part of that issue really boils down to, by failing to respond to these comments by the judge, have these partners waived any claim of error?
Well, I don't think they waived any claim of error for two reasons. First of all, the court's comments, I think, were interpreted, and I think it's a fair interpretation of the record, they were interpreted as meaning that there was no legal counsel there representing ROI. The obvious fact was that there were two representatives of ROI partnership there, and no matter what the court said, there were two of the three partners there present in court, and the court went on to make a number of comments, and I would hasten to add that Respondents' Counsel went on to make a number of comments reflecting the fact that it was recognized that both Mr. Sumption and Mr. Klein, who were present in court, had dual personas. They were there individually, and they were there as partners in ROI. There were numerous comments made by the court to that effect.
Did they have an obligation at least to step forward or to speak or to acknowledge in what capacity they were there? Otherwise, the court, I mean, like today, we have 70, 80 people here, and if someone is out there that represents someone or is a party, they would, I think there would be somewhat of an obligation at least to say we're without counsel, whatever. And there was none of that done. And as Justice Butler said, five times the court mentioned that fact, and no one said anything.
Well, I think my response is they interpreted the court's comments as referring to the absence of counsel. They were not lawyers themselves. And perhaps also very important, no one had any inkling that the court was going to apply the provisions of Section 806.02 sub 5. There was absolutely no notice that would happen, no opportunity to be heard. When the court sua sponte decided to apply that statute and grant a default judgment, the court didn't give any warning or didn't ask if
this
it was objected.
This was the trial date, wasn't it?
It was the trial date, yes.
So I was a circuit judge for a number of years before I came on this court, and I'm just trying to think. There had been some previous appearances. There had been, this is not the first time the judge looked at this, and this is a day set for trial. And one party didn't even let the judge know that, well, they were there, but in a different capacity. But if one party doesn't show up for trial, what is the normal, well, normally I would say, I'll answer my own question, is that the judge acknowledges that,
Can I ask a question?
It's easier that way, so I know the answer. It would be a default. I mean, that's not something out of the ordinary that the judge did here. You're saying it is.
I think it is, just because it was apparent to everyone that, and including the circuit judge, that there were, in fact, two representatives of the partnership there in court present, and while they indicated that they were not prepared to proceed on the claims that they had brought, they never said that they weren't prepared to proceed in defense of the claims that the respondents had brought, nor did they ever indicate, well, that's sure. Essentially it.
Mr. Scarlett, would you correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't one of the partners actually attend the hearing with an attorney representing him in his individual capacity?
That's absolutely right.
So you had an attorney there representing one of the partners, yet neither of the partners nor the attorney spoke up the repeated times that the court said that there's nobody here on behalf of the partnership. Is this not really a shift in strategy post-trial?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think it's a shift in strategy at all. It's an anomaly that really became apparent as the case went on. I mean, at that day and at that time, counsel's presence was to represent one individual on a motion for continuance related to the filing of bankruptcy by Mr. Ammerman, and it certainly wasn't an expectation that the court would be applying the default judgment provision.
Do all the partners and the partnership have the same interest?
No, they don't, and the record reflects that they don't all have the same interest.
Well, then how can you say that the two partners are representing the partnership?
Well, I don't think that it's the law in Wisconsin that a partnership has to act by all the partners. It's not the law. The law is that the partnership can act by one or more of the partners.
You mean Ammerman has 51% of the interest. That's what you're referring to?
Yes, yeah, that's reflected in the record.
Yeah. As opposed to a interest in something, you know, a different legal interest or a different factual.
That's what I meant. Do they all have the same legal interest?
I think I understand your question now.
Yeah, I'm not interested in the partnership interest.
So you're not talking about the percentage?
No, I don't
interest.
Care about that.
They all have the same interest, I believe.
Counsel, this is the problem or a problem that I have with your argument. As Justice Butler notes, the partner Klein was present at the January hearing with an attorney. And the court entered a default. Justice Butler read into the record the five different occasions when the judge made reference to representation by ROI or lack thereof. Then the court set a hearing on damages, or for trial and damages. And Klein's attorney then took over representation of ROI at those subsequent hearings on damages. And as I understand the facts, that the hearing or the trial on damages took 2 days and is actually scheduled in 2 one-day increments, and so almost took a year to complete. And the court issued its order the following March. So default January of, I don't know if either year, 2005, let's say, the decision in March of 2006, I believe, on the damages. And yet no one during all of that time ever raised the issue of, I interpreted what you meant at that January 2005 hearing as, was there any legal representation by counsel? No one ever raised that interpretation of those five statements of the court. And it wasn't raised, as I recall, until the notice of appeal. Am I correct that no one raised this default issue, even though at least 16 months had passed, until the notice of appeal was filed?
You are correct. I don't think we were obligated to raise the issue, but you certainly are correct that no one raised the issue.
This Court's a great believer in a waiver. If you don't bring it up right away, you're out. So why isn't it waived?
Well, again, because it was a final, in combination with the award of damages, it was a final judgment of the Court. It's not like a ruling on evidence or a ruling on jury instructions where clearly if you don't object, there's a waiver. It is a final judgment of the Court. And I don't think that it has ever been the law in Wisconsin that one has to object to the final judgment of the Court in order to have an appealable final judgment. I think the statutes say to the contrary, that a final judgment of the Court is an appealable matter. And I think that's what we have here. I certainly appreciate and anticipated that there would be some discussion of the possibility of some sort of waiver. Again, I think it also is important to recognize that the circuit court did this sua sponte. There was no warning that this was going to happen, no opportunity to be heard in the sense that the court never asked anyone present if they wanted to be heard on this. And, of course, the court never did anything to determine that there was a factual basis for the entry of a default judgment, which I believe the statute also requires.
I don't recall. I read the transcript or part of the transcript of the January or something from the January 16th proceedings. That is the request to withdraw counsel. That was a week prior to the default judgment being entered, the date of the scheduled trial date. But at that time, the judge, I kind of smiled because it was clear to me that the judge was up to here, and may the record reflect I'm pointing to about 3 inches above my eyes with this case. The case had four scheduling conferences, and the judge was particularly frustrated with Ammerman and suggested that the judge wasn't going to let Ammerman try to manipulate this matter and get this case further delayed.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, Justice. I think that's apparent from the record. But I don't think that's the issue.
Tell me, if you would, you want to win this case. I understand that. What kind of opinion do you want this court to write that makes sense for you to win it and makes sense in partnership law? Right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Sure.
So, what kind of decision do you expect? What kind of rule of law do you want to come out of this case as to the default judgment issue, and then we'll go on to interest? Go ahead.
Sure. What I believe the court should rule is that when a party actually shows up for trial and when there has been no indication from the party of an unwillingness to...
To stop you.
Okay.
That's a conclusion. We have to start at the beginning. When there's a partnership, who's a defendant? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
In
of
this
course.
Case?
Of course.
Okay. When there's a partnership...
Actually, a plaintiff.
A plaintiff, okay. When there's a plaintiff who's a partnership, right, and are there individual partners here also who are plaintiffs?
Yes.
The caption just reads the individual. The caption just reads individuals. It doesn't say the partnership. Does it say it then? Okay, sorry. Okay, and the next one. All right. So, okay. You've got plaintiffs who are individual partners, and you've got the partnership, all plaintiffs. All right. When that happens, go ahead. Then what rule of law do we have?
As long as the partnership is present in a legally recognized form.
That's the issue in the case. Is it present? I want you to tell us, unless I'm wrong, you should tell us what constitutes presence of a partnership in a case.
The presence of any member of that partnership.
Okay. So if there's any member of that partnership who is physically in the courtroom, right,
yes,
and making an argument, right,
yes,
then that partnership is present. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Chief, if I could interrupt.
I'm just trying to see what the rule of law is.
Exactly, and I want to focus in on this question. Is there any requirement that a partnership need to appear by way of counsel?
There is not. I believe that is unlike the situation with a corporation, which must appear by counsel. Partnership need not appear by counsel.
So it's your position that any time does it have to be a partner or the majority of partners or the majority of partnership interest, at what point does the partnership appear?
When a partner appears.
All right.
When a partner shows up, I suppose. Huh? That's what you're saying?
No.
That's right.
Does it matter if the partners have different, and I don't mean their interests in the partnership, but different legal interests in the case? You know, partners don't always agree. Sometimes they disagree. So in the rule of law you're setting forth, does it mean that all the partners have to have the same legal interest in the matter?
No, it does not, because in a legal sense, as partners, they do all have the same interest. They all represent the partnership, and they can act for the partnership under Wisconsin partnership law.
How many attorneys were attorneys of record representing the partnership in this case prior to the entry of the default?
I'm sorry, I don't remember. There were several, but I don't remember how many.
It seems to me that in the calculation of whether or not, let me ask this because I'm not sure, in the calculation of whether or not someone, the partnership has appeared, is it fair for the circuit court to rely on the history of appearance by counsel?
Oh, I don't think so. I think the court has to look at what the reality is at that particular moment in time, mm-hmm, which in this case means that the partnership was there in terms of the presence of two of the partners, but there was no legal counsel.
So your rule of law from the case is where a partnership is a plaintiff, as well as the individual partners are plaintiffs, where some individual partners are represented by counsel and others are not, where the partnership itself has been represented by counsel during the proceedings, but at this hearing, right, at this hearing, the partnership is not represented by counsel. Where the judge asks, in effect, for the appearances, and the only appearances are made by the partners as individuals, no one specifically saying, I represent the partnership too, that's good enough.
Have I
misstated something?
I think in this case the court announced the appearances.
Okay, but no one corrected that.
That's true, yes.
And so you want that to say that is an appearance by the partnership?
I believe it is.
Is the standard of review erroneous exercise of discretion?
It's a mixed issue of law and fact, I dare say, and
In other words, the standard review for entry of a default judgment is whether or not the circuit court erroneously exercises discretion in entering a default?
I think that's right. And the court's finding in that regard has to reflect the facts and the reality. And it has to also, of course, demonstrate a reasoned process which arrives at that conclusion. And we don't have that here. We don't have the court's reasoning in this regard.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Andrew Erlinson. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, respondents, and cross-petitioners, Pat Howden and Susan Scholl. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. I'll be addressing the three issues that were briefed to the Court. First, the Circuit Court did properly exercise its discretion in entering the default judgment. Second, its award of damages was based on a proper standard of law and was not clearly erroneous. And third, that the Circuit Court properly awarded pre-judgment or pre-verdict interest on the recovery by Howden and Scholl because the $200,000 damages awarded were equitable. I'd like to begin my remarks by pointing out from the January 23, 2002 transcript that was the subject of much of the discussion that at the outset of that hearing, the Court stated, appearances please, at page 2, line 3 and 4. Counsel, Ms. Cederholm, stated, Kristen Cederholm on behalf of the plaintiff, Robert Klein. Mr. Klein himself stated, Robert Klein. Brian Sumption, referred to in the transcript as Mr. Sumption, stated, Brian Sumption. There was no other appearance by any plaintiff or anybody on that side of the V. The Court did not note an appearance by ROI or by anybody. The parties themselves.
So what? You just heard the proposed rule of law from your opposite counsel as far as what's wrong with when the Court knew that these were partners, but they represented themselves individually. What's wrong with the rule of law that he's requesting that then the Court could not grant a default?
I'm reminded of the saying that 90% of life is showing up. There is, by definition, it's insufficient. There's another 10% that needs to happen. And a presence is not an appearance. There isn't a lot of law on what it takes to appear. But that law that does exist suggests that it takes more than just showing up.
Well, counsel, what about the I note that Mr. Strother refers to Black's Law Dictionary, page 19 of his brief. Appearance is defined as a coming into court as party to a suit, either in person or by an attorney, whether a plaintiff or a defendant. Now, when you have two, you concede that a partnership doesn't have to have an attorney to represent it. Is that correct?
I think that I'd have to concede that because Mr. Ammerman acted on behalf of all the plaintiffs at various times.
So if a partnership doesn't need to have an attorney to appear and you have two partners in court, why does that not constitute an appearance?
Because, Justice Butler, the root word of the term appearance is appear. And Black's Law Dictionary importantly defines the word appear as, quote, to be properly before a court as a fact or matter of which it can take notice. So the burden is not on the court to assess a silent set of individuals or individuals who identify only themselves who may have dual capacities in a case and ascertain for itself who's acting in what capacity.
But they're sitting right there.
True. And it is the burden. I think the court gave them every opportunity when it noted on four different occasions that it appeared that the partnership wasn't present. And there was a colloquy on that very subject at page 50 as the court was trying to get his head around what exactly was going on this day of trial that he was so clear a week before was going forward, and then to have chaos and requests for continuances despite his clear admonitions a week before. And at line 2, picking up at page 50 of that transcript, the court says, well, But the partnership is unrepresented here. You represent Mr. Klein, you being Attorney Cederholm, to which she answered, right. Mr. Sumption is here representing himself, Ms. Cederholm, no, the court, and there's nobody representing the partnership. No one corrected this. No one spoke up.
Maybe no one has to represent the partnership. When I went to law school, there was a lot of discussion as to whether the partnership is an entity or whether the partnership really isn't an entity at all. It's an aggregate of individuals, right?
Correct.
Okay. So that's that is a potential one difference between a corporation, which is an entity, separate and apart from the shareholders, right? Okay. So if you take the view, what view does Wisconsin take? Does it view the partnership as an entity or an aggregate of partners?
Justice Abramson, I don't know that there is a case on that subject. I know that generally partners can bind the partnership through their actions. And just as partnerships can bind the partnership through their action, partners also can bind the partnership through their inaction. And in this case, to stand idly by, silent, as this proceeding went on and on, no one speaking, no one acting on behalf of the partnership, and the two individuals present, if the court will go back and review that transcript.
But doesn't that go more towards the question of waiver as opposed to the question of appearance?
That is a threshold question on the default, and it implicates very important considerations of policy that this court noted at great length in Village of Trebolo versus McCroot last year. And that is that issues at the trial court level, raising those issues, allow the trial court to correct or avoid alleged errors in the first place and eliminate the need for appeals. It also gives both the parties and the trial judge notice of the issue and a fair opportunity to address the objection. Here we are, in many ways, ROI's argument is based on an ex post facto interpretation of what might have been an equivocal statement by the circuit court about whether representing meant was there counsel or nobody representing meant there's nobody here acting on behalf of the partnership or representing its interests. And again, the waiver rule says that it's the party's duty to raise those issues in the first instance, because this court, no appellate court, is in as good a position as a trial court to receive these objections and hear and consider these issues in the first instance. The responsibility is on the party. We're here in the highest court in the land trying to decide what the circuit court meant on January 23rd, 2002, about a trial that was the end of 2.5 years of litigation, about an action that was based on facts that arose in 1995. Because two individuals stood mute and sat idly by, allowed a default to occur, the 2 weeks before the order entering and confirming the order of default was entered, no motion, no objection, 16 months of post-default proceedings, no motion to reopen, no suggestion that there was a misinterpretation or a misunderstanding. And we're in the Supreme Court talking about it in 2005.
Not six.
Correct. And
against whom was judgment entered in this case?
The partnership, Your Honor.
Partnership. What about the individual partners?
The individual partners sued in a kind of a strange way. They sued individually and then doing business as a partnership. And there was always this sort of unclear dual capacity. We counterclaimed against all the plaintiffs because the partnership was at fault and various members of the partnership were acting outside the partnership in the conspiracy that led to the finding of liability. And so the judgment itself is against the partnership. The action...
Not against the individuals.
No, but the individuals do have liability in their capacity as partners.
That's right.
For the wrongful acts of the partnership
that's
under 178.12.
That's my point. So it doesn't matter really who the judgment is against because they'll be personally liable.
Correct. And I think the court noted that in his decision in deciding to let the chips fall where they may and whether the case will go forward as a matter of economics and whether Howden and Scholl wanted to pursue the individuals. I think that there is a remark in the transcript from January 23rd that touches on that very point. So I don't know that the court was not cognizant of what it was doing. I think the court clearly was. And certainly well within his discretion in considering whether or not someone had appeared on behalf of the partnership. Presence does not mean appearance. They are not synonymous. As Mr. Strother noted in his remarks to the court, a meaningless appearance is not an appearance.
One of the grounds for opening up a default judgment or determining whether there's erroneous exercise of discretion is that there's a valid defense, right?
Correct.
All right. The partners, at least two of the partners, at least somebody was there who was a partner. Did they put up a defense?
No. Mr. Sumption and Klein, the day they were there, Mr. Sumption really didn't have anything to offer. He identified himself and said he didn't really know what was going on and hadn't been getting notices.
So that was his defense?
Yes. Mr. Klein had essentially put the matter off on Mr. Ammerman, saying he was the one who was the operator, he was the central figure, he has all the facts, I can't make him come up here, and if he can't testify, I don't have any evidence, and I can't do it myself, and I can't make him come to Wisconsin, so I really have no power here. And so the defense was a non-defense. The defense was helplessness. And given the proceedings that preceded the January 23rd trial date, the circuit court was not receptive to the notion that more delay was in order because Mr. Klein needed to compel Mr. Ammerman's attendance to Wisconsin. He couldn't. A subpoena can't bring him here.
Mr. Erlinson, I'm interested by your comment that a presence is not an appearance. I think back to the days when I was a criminal practitioner, and you could go into a criminal court and a defendant could be brought in, stand mute, not enter a plea, not say a word, whether represented by counsel or not represented by counsel, do absolutely nothing, yet the state still had to meet its burden of proof. And I don't think anybody would characterize the presence in court as a non-appearance. Why should it be different for civil?
The criminal laws of this state and the states in this country, by definition, the penalty is a deprivation of liberty. There are many circumstances in which a criminal defendant is given additional rights. A criminal defendant cannot be compelled to testify against himself or herself. A criminal defendant is in many ways protected in ways a civil litigant is not. And keep in mind, please, in this matter, that ROI started this fight. They sued Howden and Scholl 4 years after this deal went kaput. When a party avails itself of the civil forum in the courts of the state, there is a responsibility that comes along with it. And it is not an onerous responsibility to state an appearance at the beginning of a hearing, to correct a misimpression, presuming that that's what existed on January 23rd, that there was nobody there for the partnership, to simply speak up is not an onerous burden. But to simply show up is not enough in the civil realm. And the court, there's been a suggestion.
If I might, let me ask you a question about something else that really hasn't been touched upon, and that's the issue of prejudgment interest. I'm especially interested in why you feel that prejudgment interest was okay here, given the fact that there was basically a couple of days of trial to set damages. Usually, I think prejudgment interest is granted in a situation where you're dealing with liquidated damages or clearly ascertainable damages. How do you justify prejudgment interest in this case?
Thank you, Justice Chris. It was probably time to move on. Prejudgment interest goes back as a concept in our state to 1899 in Laycock versus Parker, which was cited a lot in the briefs and has been discussed a fair deal in decisions of this court, notably decisions in the 60s and 70s. And the test for whether prejudgment or pre-verdict interest is appropriate is whether damages are liquidable. And Justice Crooks, as you noted, liquidated and liquidable are not exactly synonymous terms. Liquidable is the term that this court in 1899 came up with as the fall between strictly liquidated claims and those that require proof. And damages are liquidable when there is a reasonably certain standard of measurement by the correct application of which one can ascertain the amount he or she owes. And thus, it is the standard for measuring damages that must be certain. The ultimate measure of damages or the opposing party's obligation to pay them need not be so certain. Now, in this case, there were alternative theories of damages advanced. But the theory of damages that the court seized on and accepted is the general rule of damages that a non-breaching buyer of real estate, which is what Howden and Scholl essentially were. It was a tort claim, but their interest in a contract had been frustrated. Is the difference between the fair market value of the property at the time of the breach and the contract purchase price. Now, that's a rule that goes back to 1856. That's Hall versus Roberts. And that rule hasn't changed. And so if the question as to those damages is whether or not the standard for their measure is reasonably certain, it's a 150-year-old rule of law. It's pretty certain at this point. So the standard is is the critical inquiry. And Laycock versus Parker specifically contemplated those situations where the standard for measuring damages was clear and it required a market valuation of something. And Laycock specifically discussed that and said that damages are liquidable when a party can just go find out what the market value of the thing in question is and calculate his or her damages. And the interesting thing about this case and the unusual thing about this case is that not only could ROI have determined the market value of the property at the time of its wrongful conduct, it had done so. It had actually valued the property and submitted that value and declared it under penalty of perjury in its bankruptcy proceeding. Its bankruptcy schedules were signed 4 days after its wrongful conduct torpedoed the contract, and they were submitted 5 days later.
What was the value of the property that the court determined as of the date of the breach?
$1.5 million.
And what other value could the court have determined on that date? Maybe 1.3, because that's what was bid 6 days before the breach?
Justice Bradley, it raises a question of competency of evidence. And the only evidence that there was to support that point was, as you point out, the $1.3 million contract. But that contract was entered into at a time when the property was in distress. There had been a foreclosure sale. The property had been auctioned off. And in between that time of the auction and the time that the circuit court could approve the foreclosure sale and thus convey title to the property to the auction bidder and away from ROI investments, ROI, as debtors often do, filed for bankruptcy. And that imposes an automatic stay on the foreclosure proceeding.
Let me ask, didn't the Scholl and Howden make a bid of initially 1.6, if I recall?
Correct, sir.
And then, as I recall, there's something in the record that suggests that they brought it down subsequently to 1.3 because the tenant wanted a lot, as tenants do, wanted a lot of improvements if they were going to sign the lease again and continue the lease. And the improvements would cost about $300,000, and so that's how they came to the 1.3. Is that correct or incorrect?
That's correct. There were a couple of business reasons why they wanted a discounted price, well, not the least of which was the improvements.
That gets me to my point. It seems to me that you're arguing if the method of calculation is reasonably ascertainable. I submit that on the date of breach, if the court had said the fair market value was 1.5, I'd say, well, is there evidence to support that finding given my standard of review? And I'd say, sure, there is. Look at the bankruptcy thing. If the court had said 1.3, here I am sitting in review, and I'd say the same question. Is there evidence to support that finding? And I'd say, sure, there is. Look at what the actual offer was made twice, 1.3, and before that 1.6, but subtracted 300,000. So I would say, from that, too, because the standard review is whether or not there's evidence to support the finding of the court with regard to value. So how can you argue that in advance of the breach, the value, or advance of the lawsuit, rather, the value is reasonably ascertainable or some certain to incur prejudgment interest? Because it could have been 1.3, it could have been 1.6.
And again, the beauty of this case is ROI had conducted that valuation. It had conducted that inquiry for its own right, in its own interests, and declared under penalty of perjury what that property was worth within days of its wrongful conduct. ROI cannot claim ignorance as to that valuation. And so if the question is, was the standard for measuring damages reasonably certain, it was a 150-year-old rule of law. And if the question is, could they have ascertained the value of the property at the time of its wrongful conduct, the answer is undoubtedly yes, because they had in fact conducted that valuation. So in this particular context, prejudgment interest is particularly appropriate, because you really don't have a legitimate dispute as to what the value was at the time of the wrongful conduct. You had the bad actor conducting the valuation at that time.
Then what was the two-day trial about?
The two-day trial was about...
Wasn't it about that very issue?
It was not about that issue. The only evidence as to value was certified copies of the bankruptcy schedules. ROI did not offer a valuation witness. They had a single witness, and he acknowledged at the outset of his testimony that he wasn't competent to value real estate. The evidence that took 2 days was evidence related to incidental, consequential expenses and losses that accrued to Howden and Scholl as a result of the wrongful conduct.
If you were going to prevail on the benefit of the bargain theory, is that correct? I mean, you had that as an alternative approach. Loss of bargain is one, benefit of the bargain is the other. Is that right?
Alternative is the way it was framed. We framed it that way. I think with hindsight, as they do about a lot of things, it probably could have been phrased differently. Because what they really were is those losses over and on top of what the loss of the value of the property, there were all these additional costs. There was an additional transaction, intermediary transaction, where they had to buy duplexes because of the tax code. And so wading through those expenses and attorney's bills, and that took a long time. But if the question and the focus is on what could ROI have done, and if this truly was an alternative theory, ROI could have ascertained what it owed and tendered that amount. And had they tendered the actual damages that Howden and Scholl incurred, I dare say that Howden and Scholl would have a very difficult time walking into court and saying, well, but we have an alternative theory. So the question is really, in terms of assessing actual damages under the contract purchase price versus fair market value formula, that standard is reasonably certain, and there was no genuine dispute, and Howden and Scholl had not grossly inflated their claim. And under this Court's rulings in Congress Bar and Restaurant versus Transamerica, Dahl versus Housing Authority and City of Madison, and Wyandotte Chemicals versus Royal Electric, that's the question. A dispute about what's owed or a dispute about whether it's owed has never been enough to knock out prejudgment interest. Otherwise, as Justice Hansen pointed out in the Dahl opinion, what would be the point? As long as there was any dispute,
there would never be prejudgment as interest as compensation on the amounts owed. Now, with respect to prejudgment interest, this Court's attention, I think, is best characterized as freshening and tidying up the law. It's been a while since this Court has addressed the issue, and there are some loose ends out there. One of those loose ends was grabbed by the Court of Appeals in its prejudgment interest reversal, and it's Teff versus Unity Health Plan. And that was a very complicated set of facts, and parts of the damages formula were real clear and prescribed by contract, and then parts were more speculative. And the Court did a really good job walking through the prejudgment interest analysis until it sort of ended with a clunk at the end, and it seized on some language from the case of Chevron versus Deloitte Touche, and it quoted that language, which I think is at odds with this Court's rulings in Laycock and Laycock's progeny. And in that Chevron case, Judge Cici writing the opinion, as kind of a throwaway comment as part of the remand, stated that there were issues of fact regarding damages, so prejudgment interest was not appropriate. And that overstates it, and I believe it oversimplifies things. Judge Cici cited the Nicholson Home Insurance and Johnson versus Pearson AgriSystems cases, where this Court grappled with the notion that personal injury plaintiffs really, maybe as a matter of policy, should recover interest on certain aspects or liquidable aspects of their claims, but that it was really up to the legislature to make that change in state public policy. And Judge Cici's opinion doesn't discuss Laycock versus Parker or Dahl versus Housing Authority or Congress Bar and Restaurant or Wyandotte. And so rather than interpret it as what would be fairly characterized as a radical departure from Laycock and its progeny and establishing an entirely new rule of law that wherever there are factual disputes, prejudgment interest isn't appropriate, the law is best tidied and clarified a bit and to reassert and freshen the holdings from Wyandotte, Dahl, and Congress Bar and Restaurant. And the rule of those cases does not change Laycock versus Parker. However, it does acknowledge when there are exceptions to the rule of Laycock versus Parker. Laycock versus Parker stays the same. If there's a reasonably certain standard of measurement by which the correct application of which one can ascertain the amount owed, prejudgment interest is appropriate, except where, one, there's a genuine dispute as to the amount owed and the claimant has grossly inflated his or her claim. That is the synthesis of the Congress Bar, Dahl versus Housing Authority, and Wyandotte cases. Then there is another category of factual disputes that should be recognized as an exception to the prejudgment interest rule. But those disputes aren't present here. And that is a dispute that goes to the very method of calculating damages. Now, that kind of dispute and that holding has its roots in Jones versus Jenkins, which was a case that involved a contingent fee agreement between an attorney and his client. The agreement was ambiguous, and thus the Court resorted to parole evidence. And there were conflicting factual accounts on that point. And because the dispute went to the very method of calculating the damages, the case did not fall under the Laycock versus Parker rubric because there was no reasonably certain standard for measuring damages.
Counsel, I find very interesting the argument and note that as I'm looking at this treatise that I often look at, the law of damages in Wisconsin, that my guess is that maybe you looked at it too, because maybe not, but a lot of the cases that you're referencing are set forth in here. And yet I still come back to the, I'm reading from 35.7 of interest on damages. In order to recover interest, there must be a fixed and determinate amount, and the amount of the claim must be known and determined or readily determinable. It goes on to state, the claim must be ascertainable by a reasonable standard of measurement. And that's what you seem to be arguing. But there's also authority not just for the reasonable standard of measurement, but, as this comment goes on, prejudgment interest may be awarded only if the amount of damages is ascertainable or determinable prior to the judicial determination.
And I think the determinable or ascertainable language is a correct statement. And I think if we go back to the beginning at Laycock versus Parker, it contemplates this very situation. And where it is a question of market value, where all one has to do to determine the amount of damages owed is ascertain the market value of something, it's ascertainable. It is determinable. And so in that sense, the test is met. There is an exception that exists, and that's what protects parties against whom claims of prejudgment interest are made. Where there is a genuine dispute, and the claimant has grossly inflated his or her claim, prejudgment interest is inappropriate. And it is that exception that protects opposing parties and provides the check or balance that prevents claimants from overreaching and grossly inflating claims and putting opposing parties in the position where they either pay up or have to face an interest clock. If somebody's overreached, prejudgment interest isn't appropriate. That's not the case here. Harbin Scholl asked for $200,000 in damages based on the $1.5 million valuation, and that's precisely what they recovered. I see my red light is up. Unless any of the justices have further questions, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Counsel. Strother, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to answer one of the Chief Justice's questions, whether a partnership is an aggregate or an entity. It is, in Wisconsin law, I believe, an aggregate of the partners. I think that the record here reflects that the Circuit Court believed it was an aggregate of the partners, because that record also reflects that after judgment was rendered on damages, the Court allowed the respondents to execute on the judgment against Mr. Klein. It's in the record. We attempted to get the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court to disallow that, but precisely that was allowed, and Mr. Klein, as a partner, was made to suffer the consequences of being a member of a partner when the respondents attempted to execute. Justice Bradley, I believe, was asked a question about whether there was a defense on the part of the ROI partners. Well, there wasn't at the trial because they didn't have an opportunity to present a defense. The Circuit Court, by granting the default judgment and not requiring proof of any facts by the respondents, completely relieved the respondents of the burden of proof on their claims, the claims as to which default judgment was granted. No notice, no opportunity to be heard, no requirement that any sort of facts be put before the Court to demonstrate a right to even have a judgment.
What should I give any weight to this? Immediately before the default judgment was granted, you had a dismissal of the plaintiff's cause of action, of course, plaintiff being ROI, and the dismissal of the plaintiff's cause of action. And the Court, as I understand it, dismissed the plaintiff's cause of action.
Yes.
Including ROI, because there was no one who appeared for ROI who was who could go forward on the claim. Is that wrong?
No, I think that's wrong. I think the dismissal occurred for failure to prosecute. And, of course, there's a different section of the Civil Procedure Code that relates to dismissal for failure to prosecute. And I think that was exactly why the Circuit Court dismissed ROI's affirmative claims, failure to prosecute.
Okay. Thank you.
How does that differ from a failure to go forth and present a claim?
I'm sorry?
How does that differ from failure to go forth and present a claim?
Well, I think that's what it is. It is the failure to go forth and present a claim. But what we're talking about here with the default judgment is the claim of the respondents, which they had a burden to go forward and present.
Was there anyone on that day ready to go forth on behalf of ROI in defense? The court had just determined that there was no one on behalf of ROI and others to go forward to prosecute. Was there anyone ready to go forward to defend?
I could only speculate. I know that the two partners were there, and I can only speculate as to whether they would have actively participated in any efforts by the court to determine whether there was a factual basis for the entry of default judgment. I don't know. But they certainly didn't have the opportunity, as the statute seems to suggest that they should have.
Did they object to the entry of the default against the partnership?
They did not object. They did not object. It happened quite unexpectedly.
Could you speak to the prejudgment interest issue?
Sure. I think this is a case where this is not a case of widgets, if I can go back to my economics training in college. This is not a case of widgets where we can go out in the marketplace and say, widgets cost X number of dollars. We can find it on the Internet. We can find it in some commercially accessible source. This is not a case of widgets where we can go to some we can go to some source and with reasonable certainty ascertain the value of the claim. This was a case where we have a unique piece of real estate. This was a case where the court could readily have found a value, for example, of $1.3 million based on the testimony of the respondents alone. My red light is on, so.
Question, if I may, Chair. The premise that presence equals appearance. Are you arguing that as a matter of law, presence equals appearance?
Essentially, I am arguing that in the absence of some compelling evidence suggesting that presence is not any sort of a meaningful presence. If, for example, somebody showed up intoxicated and unable to function, well, that would obviously be a fairly extreme example of somebody who was present but in no meaningful way was ready to address the court.
If you were a member of a 15-person law firm and it was an LLP, a partnership, and I was a circuit court judge and I called the case and expected you to be there, but you weren't, but lo and behold, one of your partners was present on a different case in the audience, could I enter a default judgment?
Well, I think if he didn't step forward and be recognized as one of the participants in the lawsuit, I would agree. In this case, Mr. Klein, Mr. Sumption did step forward, and they were present before the court as participants in the lawsuit and not as somebody who was sitting in the back of the room waiting for another case to be called.
Thank you, Mr. Stroman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Erlinson, for your arguments today about the partnership liability. And it's been a while since we had a partnership case. That concludes our hearing on 03-2249, John R. Ammerman et al. Versus Howden et al. We'll take a few moments recess so the students may leave, and I believe there will be other students who will be entering the courtroom.